Today is Wednesday, April 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
What they want from the United Kingdom leaving the European Union is very different to what the Prime Minister May's Conservative Party want.
That's reporter Catherine Field. We'll have the latest on Brexit coming up. Also ahead, U.S. President Donald Trump offers mixed signals on whether he plans to close the U.S. southern border with Mexico, and Algeria's president resigns. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump offered mixed signals on whether he plans to close the U.S. southern border with Mexico to thwart the surge of undocumented migrants trying to seek asylum in the U.S. No border closing decision has been made, and Trump later said he is ready to close it if he feels he has to. International Edition's Lori London spoke with Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, professor at George Mason University, who specializes in U.S.-Mexico border relations, security, immigration and human smuggling.
We're definitely seeing a crisis at the border, but I see it as a manufactured crisis at the border. The president of the United States, Donald Trump, had a forecast of this crisis since his campaign. He was talking about building a big, beautiful wall and the fact that MS-13 was coming with undocumented immigration from Central America and drugs and a threat to the United States was coming through the southern border. The construction of a wall has been a priority for his government to the extent that there was the biggest government shutdown in the history of the United States earlier this year, and now he declared a national emergency, and maybe he's going to shut down the border. However, we need to think about this. Who is moving this caravan? These caravans are not organic. The situation in the Northern Triangle has not changed dramatically. The economic conditions and the gang expansion has been maintained relatively stable. The situation is really bad, but the communication and the utilization of social media to spread out the word that this is now or never, that you can ask for asylum and you will be released in the United States. That's a reality.
You're saying that these huge caravans of families and such crossing or trying to get asylum here in the U.S. at the Mexican border is not an organic thing that just evolved from them needing to flee, but rather there's some sort of movement to get them to be afraid that if they don't do it now, they won't ever be able to?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Having studied for several years social movements, I can see that these movements are not organic. Caravan organizers have been telling people you can go. They facilitate transportation. They facilitate information about how to apply for asylum, how to request asylum. These are your rights. You can do it and you will be released. And two more caravans are coming. The current administration, they are getting what they want to portray this image of a crisis at the border.
But are they fleeing because they are in a situation where there is violence and their children's lives are at risk and the conditions are so bad that compels them to follow what these people are saying?
That's definitely true. The conditions are terrible for them. That's a matter of fact. Conditions are very bad. They understand that once they get to the United States, they are going to get a job. There are pull and push factors, extreme poverty, violence in their neighborhood. The conditions are not good at all. They know that once they make it to the United States, they will get a job and they are willing to do that because their life is going to change.
Aren't they concerned about this hard line that the Trump administration is taking on immigration?
Yes, but all of them know what is going on, and they know that the capacity of the detention centers in the United States is not enough, and they understand that many of them have been released. This is the information that they are getting from the smugglers, from the caravan organizers, and from what they know.
As you mentioned, yes, there is now a crisis on the border, but not necessarily the crisis the president has described as far as violent people coming in. These are mostly, it would appear, to be families. But these aid groups are saying that we are facing now a humanitarian crisis that's pretty dire. Some of these people have been in the same clothes for days, no food.
It is a big tragedy for everybody, for the United States, for Mexico, and especially for migrants. These people are leaving everything that they have, their homes, their belongings, everything. They don't know what's going to happen to them. And there is a promise that those that qualify to apply for asylum that they are going to wait for the hearings in immigration court. They will have to wait in Mexico. Mexico will have to figure out how to deal with this humanitarian crisis at the Mexico-U.S. border on the Mexican side. This is where the biggest crisis is going to be taking place. What are they going to do? They lost everything that they have. The redistribution of resources for the Border Patrol that has to search for drugs and criminal groups, terrorists, are now focusing on family. How you are utilizing resources that you can spend for what they have to be spent. Instead of spending resources on a wall, this is a tragedy for everybody. This is a manufactured crisis that is affecting everybody, including the American citizen.
That was Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, professor at George Mason University, who specializes in U.S.-Mexico border relations, security, immigration, and human smuggling. She was speaking with International Edition's Lori London. Well, a Chinese woman was arrested after entering U.S. President Donald Trump's Florida retreat carrying a device containing malicious computer software last week. According to court documents filed by federal prosecutors this week, Yujing Zhang approached a secret service agent at President Trump's Mar-a-Lago retreat in Palm Beach seeking entrance to the private club, claiming she was a member. Although agents could not initially find her name on the membership list, she was eventually allowed inside after a club manager thought she was the daughter of a member. The Associated Press' Matt Small has more.
Four cell phones, two Chinese passports, one laptop computer, an external hard drive, plus a thumb drive containing malware. That's what officials say was found on Yujing Zhang Saturday after they say she lied to Secret Service agents to gain entry to President Trump's Mar-a-Lago club in Florida. They say she initially claimed club membership and was there to use the pool, but among all the items she had, a swimsuit wasn't one of them. The 32-year-old, who's charged with making false statements to federal agents and illegally entering a restricted area, will remain in custody pending a hearing next week. Matt Small, Washington.
European political leaders are spending today looking for clarity in what British Prime Minister Theresa May was offering them in a Brexit deal as they wrapped up last night's meeting. May reached out to opposition parties with a proposal on a withdrawal agreement that she hopes will go through Parliament. However, political and business leaders are skeptical. Reporter Catherine Field sheds light on the ever-changing political scene of the UK as parties on both sides of the table express their concerns over Brexit.
What they want from the United Kingdom leaving the European Union is very different to what the Prime Minister May's Conservative Party want. For example, the Labour Party are very keen on having a second referendum, of putting all this back to the electorate to have a say on what the future arrangement should be. Now, the Conservatives are against that. The Labour Party is also very concerned, as it would be, about workers' rights, and they want any future deal with the European Union to include a guarantee over workers' rights, because they feel that workers' rights are better protected in the European Union than they are in Britain. On top of that, a lot of Labour members of Parliament are really concerned that even if they do give way in some sort of agreement which allows this withdrawal agreement to go through Parliament, it won't be legally binding. So they're saying, well, look, this could be a trap. Because Theresa May said she will leave office sometime after the withdrawal agreement is agreed, they say that they might agree something, but it won't matter because there'll be someone else in the hot seat calling the shots, and they just won't have the same sort of leverage. On top of that, it's difficult to see how this agreement that has so far been rejected by all parliamentarians in the House of Parliament, how this agreement can get approval in just 1 week.
Also, what has been Europe's response so far to this?
Europe has been very clear. The head of the European Union's Commission, he made a statement to the European Parliament just a few hours ago, and they were very clear. He said that this, if you like, first step by the Prime Minister Theresa May to ask for a short extension to Brexit isn't going to be a given. What they're saying is that at the moment, the United Kingdom has an agreement to leave by the 12th of April. Now, what they're saying is that if the withdrawal agreement has not been signed by that day, then the United Kingdom is out of the European Union. It's as simple as that. However, they say if that deal is signed, if it's gone through Parliament, then they'll be able to stay a bit longer, possibly until May, and the possibility of even perhaps staying longer beyond that if they take part in European elections. There is a feeling that Theresa May is playing for time, that she's still no clearer, and that on Wednesday of next week, when she comes back to Europe, when she comes to this special summit just 2 days before the European Union is about to become 27 members, in just 1 week, she has to have answers. And it's not going to be enough just to hope that she can sort of swing a few things here and there and pull on a few cords. There is also a feeling that it's been dragging on and dragging on, and the longer that the European Union allows the United Kingdom to stay within the European Union, that it's sort of dragging the whole block down.
Now, also, we know that the EU is intensifying its measures for a no-deal Brexit. So what exactly would that mean?
It means that they have gone through and checked that every one of their arrangements will be able to be up and running by the 12th of April. These sorts of arrangements include visas for UK citizens leaving and living in Europe. For example, just this morning, they distributed them again to the press. They're going out on national media across the United Kingdom and across the European Union. And that is that people from the UK can stay in Europe for 90 days without needing any type of visa. But here again is the rub. They're saying very clearly that this is reciprocal. So as if the United Kingdom doesn't agree to that, then it's off the table. They're also making sure that border facilities, so as they can check which trucks are going in and out, what's being carried, those facilities are in place. And making sure that this group of what they call Sherpas, the European Union Sherpas that communicate decisions from Brussels to the different capitals, making sure those Sherpas have got the message out to the different capitals. This is what's going to happen if the United Kingdom leaves on the 12th.
That was reporter Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Paris. Among the top stories in the world, Istanbul's opposition mayoral candidate urges Turkey's elections board today to confirm his narrow victory after it began a partial recount of votes in 8 of the city's 39 districts. Uganda's government says gunmen have abducted a female American tourist and her driver in a national park near the DRC. And newly enacted Islamic laws governing gay sex and adultery in Brunei spark an international outcry. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
So this is widely...
The International Monetary Fund says global economic growth is slowing. IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde yesterday said business leaders in Washington that the global agency sees slowing growth in 70% of the world's economies.
So this is widely spread, and it's likely to improve in the course of 2019, where we see a little bit of an upswing to be expected. But it's delicate because there is a lot of uncertainty. There are country-specific issues that are unresolved, such as Brexit. And, the largest uncertainty that we have is trade tension, which has really fueled this anxiety of economic operators around the world.
She says the IMF does not expect a recession in the coming months and that regrowth may rally later this year. She also warned, however, that years of low interest rates and high debt in many countries since the 2008 economic crisis could make it hard for governments to react if there is a serious downturn. Lagarde urged countries to do more to improve their balance sheets.
In addition to that, we believe that some countries can actually afford to spend on infrastructure, on education, on broadband, and you name it. Other countries need to build or rebuild their buffers because their debt situation is of concern. And we also believe that all of them should continue the structural reforms that some of them have started, but need to continue. So to be crisis resistant, work needs to be continued.
Lagarde previewed a new IMF report being released next week. The report says rising trade tensions and tariffs hurt investment in manufacturing and job creation efforts. It also warns that the growing size of some technology firms is leading to price increases. Lagarde said governments should implement policies to encourage innovation and fair competition. Where the Solomon Islanders are heading to the polls today, surrounded by tight security amid fears of electoral interference. The Melanesian archipelago was part of an arc of insecurity around northeastern Australia following ethnic violence, rampant crime, and failing governments in the early 2000s. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
In 2003, Australia led a multinational peacekeeping effort that restored democracy to the Solomon Islands. The mission officially ended in 2017, and Australia has sent troops to monitor Wednesday's poll. In a land of rugged mountains and active volcanoes, the Solomon Islands election is a huge logistical challenge. Australian military helicopters have delivered ballot papers to remote parts of the South Pacific archipelago. There are concerns over alleged vote buying on so-called Devil's Night that falls the day before the election. Anti-corruption group Transparency Solomon Islands said that vote buying had now become a common aspect of elections in the Solomon Islands. Solomon Islands Police Commissioner Matthew Varley is urging voters to respect democracy.
People talk about Devil's Night. My question is, how much is your vote worth? How much is your voice worth? Because this is what a person's vote is. It's their right to choose the leaders of this nation. And if we're going to sell our vote for $200 or a bag of rice, then I think we can do better than that.
International diplomacy is also a feature of the election. The Solomon Islands is Taiwan's biggest ally in the South Pacific. But the caretaker Prime Minister Rick Ho has promised to review diplomatic ties with Taipei if re-elected, while downplaying fears it would mean a switch to China. There is, however, speculation that the Solomon Islands could affirm its diplomatic allegiance to China, which is a key trading partner, although such a move is denied by the archipelago's leading political parties. 15 parties are contesting the election. More than 330 candidates are competing for 50 seats in Parliament. National issues such as healthcare and infrastructure will dominate the poll. This voter is supporting her local lawmaker.
I mean, in our constituency, he's helped. For example, lots of old people. People have engines. He's helped build main roads, trucks. He's the one who's helped people.
The Solomon Islands is an archipelago in the South Pacific Ocean that lies to the northeast of Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you, Phil. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Cyclone Idai battered parts of southern Africa, wreaking havoc and creating a massive humanitarian crisis. An in-depth look at how the international community and the local governments are dealing with this evolving crisis on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
A new report finds hundreds of thousands of newborns and mothers giving birth are dying each year because the healthcare facilities lack clean water, sanitation, and hygiene. The World Health Organization and UN Children's Fund have published the first comprehensive global assessment of this situation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
Data compiled from 125 countries show one in four healthcare facilities around the world lacks basic water services, affecting 2 billion people. It also finds one in five healthcare facilities have no sanitation or basic toilet facilities, affecting 1.5 billion people. The World Health Organization and UN Children's Fund say clean water, sanitation, and hygiene services in health facilities can prevent the spread of infections and save lives. Unfortunately, they say too many facilities, especially in the least developed countries, do not have these basic services. Each year, the report says 17 million women in these countries give birth in healthcare facilities where the risk of infection is high. Tom Slaymaker is a senior statistician and WASH specialist at UNICEF. He says creating good sanitary and hygienic conditions in healthcare facilities can be achieved quickly, easily, and cheaply.
Improving hand hygiene is probably the single most important thing you can do to prevent and control infections and the spread of antimicrobial resistance. It's also a very low-cost intervention. It's relatively easy to achieve, even in low-capacity settings. But in the report, we see only half of healthcare facilities worldwide have hand hygiene facilities at the point of care.
The report notes simple hand-washing stations can be installed for 10 cents a patient, and alcohol-based hand gels can easily be put in place. Maggie Montgomery from the WHO's Water, Sanitation, Hygiene and Health Unit cites Ghana as a country that has put together a national strategy for improving WASH in its healthcare facilities. She tells VOA one factor in its success lies in the excellent job the government has done in engaging communities in the project.
Over 200 local radio stations, and these radio stations act as a mechanism for community members to voice concerns, to do informal reviews of services, to get feedback. So it really also shows you how democracy and good governance, especially at the local level, can be a major driving factor in improving services.
WHO and UNICEF researchers note more than 1 million deaths each year are linked with unclean births. They say infections account for 26% of neonatal deaths and 11% of maternal mortality. They call these statistics alarming, especially as many of the deaths are preventable by providing safe water, toilets, and hand washing in healthcare facilities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, digital mapping technology has been around for a while, but it's only recently that it's been applied to art history. University researchers are receiving grants from sources such as the Getty Foundation to build web applications for users to explore and research historic sites. VOA's Elizabeth Lee explains how technology is allowing art historians to better understand the past.
Historians increasingly are getting a new perspective on the past by connecting the world of art history with computer mapping technology. Heather McDonald is a senior program officer at the Getty Foundation.
It actually lets you think about how people lived in these spaces, moved through these spaces, how artworks interacted and would have been seen and understood in relationship to one another.
3D animation and digital mapping allow people to explore and research archaeological sites in historic cities to better understand the environment where art objects were found. Duke University art history professor Paul Jaskett directs the Wired Lab for Digital Art History and Visual Culture.
Because of the developments in computer science and in regular standard computers, even laptops, have made this kind of work much easier for art historians.
The data could include archival information that spans hundreds of years, such as a map of the growth of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. In a project called Visualizing the Mountain Estate, researchers combined digital maps and 3D modeling of the Qing Dynasty Imperial Park in China. They used survey maps and historical sources such as wood block prints, texts, and paintings from the 18th and 19th centuries to show how the park changed over time. In a project called Hidden Florence, augmented reality is used to explore art history in the home of the Renaissance. Users can interact with a 16th century map that is embedded into the application as they tour this old Italian city.
You can start to layer historical evidence or historical views or historical material onto that physical environment.
I think that's the great thing about digital art history is that it gives us all kinds of new horizons, both to answer old questions and to ask new ones.
And with more understanding of the past, it may allow for more awareness of the art that is currently on display in today's cities. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.